Studio 360.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
The summer blockbuster season has just started with The Avengers: Infinity War, which sold $640 million worth of tickets around the world in its first weekend, the biggest movie opening of all time. And in this hour of Studio 360, we are leaping into the world of comic books and superheroes as well.
He's a plague, Tony. He invades planets. He takes what he wants. He wipes out half the population. If he gets his hands on all six stones, Tony.
If Thanos needs all six, why don't we just stick this one down the garbage disposal?
No can do.
We swore an oath to protect the Time Stone with our lives.
And I swore off dairy, but then Ben & Jerry's named a flavor after me, so.
Stark raving hazelnuts.
Not Ben.
First up, a comic that depicts a real-life event that was as strange and complicated and operatic as anything in fiction. The Boxer Rebellion is one of those historical events you're supposed to know about. I'm willing to bet you don't, because I didn't. And if you don't, all the more reason to get a copy of the terrific graphic novel Boxers and Saints by the artist and author Jean Luen Yang. In the year 1900, a lot of Chinese were fed up with the Western business people and missionaries swarming over their country. The insurgency of the Boxers, as they were called, was quickly crushed by an international military coalition, including U.S. forces, but not before the Boxers had killed 30-some thousand Chinese Christian converts.
It was like this ragtag army of these poor, illiterate teenagers from the Chinese farmlands who believed that they could call the Chinese gods down from the skies, and these Chinese gods would give them superpowers.
Talk about the characters you chose to represent each side.
Both of the protagonists are fictional. So the main character in the first volume is a boy named Little Bao who grows up to become a boxer. On the other side, the main character is a young woman named Four Girl. She's born into a Chinese family, a traditional Chinese family that doesn't really accept her. And she grows up to convert to Catholicism.
And you were raised as a Christian and are still a practicing Christian, yeah?
Yeah, I'm still a practicing Catholic, yeah.
And given that you had a home team, did that make it hard to depict the boxer side even-handedly?
Well, I think like a lot of Asian American Christians, I think I grew up within this tension between Western belief systems and Eastern culture. So very much, I feel like this book, the dual nature of this book sort of expresses an ambivalence I have about my own identity.
Your scenes in which the peasants turn into warrior gods are especially dramatic. The frames get suddenly large, the colors are intense, and the faces are kind of terrifying. The book became more comic bookish at those moments and less sort of graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge comic book fan. I grew up reading comic books. I grew up reading superhero comic books. And that was one of the ways I found a connection with these boxers, with these teenagers from over 100 years ago. These young men, they first learned about the heroes of Chinese mythology through Chinese opera. So China has this long tradition of opera. And it's very colorful, it's very dramatic and very stylistic. And when I read about Chinese opera, and especially when I read about Chinese opera's place in these young men's lives, I saw a lot of connections between Chinese opera and American superhero comics.
Huh.
You know, both of these media, they tell stories about these heroes who dress in bright colors, who have superpowers, who fight these epic battles for the fate of the world. And in a lot of ways, you know how The way American geeks latch on to superheroes is sort of the way these young men in China latched on to Chinese opera. They felt hopeless and angry, and they expressed their hopelessness and anger. They dealt with their hopelessness and anger by identifying strongly with these heroes that they watched on stage.
Well, and comic book superheroes are often mostly sort of navigating between two worlds.
Yeah, that's something that my Asian American comic book friends and I talk about a lot. There are a lot of Asian Americans involved in comics right now in every level of the medium. And we wonder if in a lot of ways we're attracted to this medium because we grew up with these stories of American superheroes. And every American superhero negotiates between multiple identities, right? So Batman isn't just Batman. He's also Bruce Wayne. So in a lot of ways, I think Asian Americans and immigrants' kids in general, we can find reflections of ourselves in these characters.
Yeah. You've written other stories about the tensions between East and West and immigrants. American-born Chinese is about a kid growing up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in his school. You grew up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in your school. Am I wrong to imagine that American-born Chinese is wholly autobiographical?
It's not wholly autobiographical. It's fiction, but I did pull heavily from my own life in order to create that book. When my family first moved into the neighborhood where I spent most of my childhood, we were one of just a handful of Chinese American families there. There were so few of us that my mom actually went to the school and asked them for the addresses of the other Chinese American families. And then we went and made house calls one afternoon. We just went and met all three or four of them. Nowadays, it would be seen as something crazy, right? You wouldn't do that at all. But back then, because there were so few of us,
right,
that was an accepted thing to do.
American-born Chinese takes a kind of surreal turn when it becomes, for a while, a sitcom. And the comic relief is this character called Chin Ki, who's a caricature with buck teeth and very yellow skin. And he speaks with this extreme stereotypical accent. And he's supposed to be embarrassing. That is the point, which is part of what makes the book great. But did people at the time think, oh, my God, he's stepped over some kind of line of taste? Were you like, was it like Portnoy's Complaint among Chinese Americans?
That was definitely Chin Ki. Cousin Chin Ki was by far the most controversial part of American born
Chinese. I didn't even want to say Chin Ki because that sounded more racist.
Yeah. I did that on purpose. I get three different kinds of reactions to Cousin Chin Ki. You know, usually from older Asian Americans in their 50s and 60s, a lot of them will get to the point in the book where Chin Ki shows up and they'll tell me that character made them feel so uncomfortable that they had a hard time finishing the book from that point on. And in a lot of ways, I feel good about that because I feel like that was kind of what I was going for. Then from other folks, other readers, usually Asian Americans who are around my age or younger, a lot of them will tell me that they found Cousin Chin Ki really funny. They found him really hilarious, but they felt guilty about laughing, and they felt really it was like they were laughing with a knot in their stomach.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's good too, because that's kind of what I was going for as well. And then the minority opinion, the minority reaction that I get, every now and then somebody will come up to me and tell me, oh, you know that Cousin Chin Ki character? He's so cute. Have you ever thought about making him into like a plush doll or putting him on a t-shirt?
Oof.
And those folks,
yeah,
that makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, because that was not what I was going for at all.
That pickaninny commodification idea?
My only regret for American born Chinese is that I didn't exaggerate Cousin Chin Ki even more. Because I feel like if I had made him look even more monstrous, if I had made him look even more brightly yellow and more, you know, more exaggerated, maybe that final reaction would go away.
Yeah. So you have also done some big deal work for hire over the last few years, such as the Avatar Last Airbender comic book, which I have to point out is different from the bad Last Airbender movie that came out in 2010. So how did you get that gig?
That was an amazing thing that happened. I was a huge fan of that show. So Avatar The Last Airbender, to my mind, it was probably the best American-produced animation show ever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the writing in that show was just stellar. It was meant for kids 7 and up, but they dealt with all sorts of really complex topics like, you know, culture and the nature of evil, all sorts of things, family dynamics. Well, after the show ended, they announced that they're going to make a live-action movie based on the show, and I was really excited about that. Then they announced that M. Night Shyamalan was going to direct it, and I was a little bit less excited. I thought, well, you know, I liked his first two or three movies.
Yep.
And then they announced the casting, and in the show is set in a fantasy world, but it's a fantasy world based on real-world Asian cultures. You know, it pulls heavily from Japan and from China, from the Inuit cultures. But when they casted the live action version, they gave all of the major heroic roles to white actors. And to me, it just felt like yet another instance of yellowface, of Hollywood's practice of giving these roles that would most logically go to Asian or Asian American actors and giving them to white actors.
And then when did you start writing the comic?
The way I got the comic gig was I was so mad about this movie that I did a webcomic about how I was never going to see this movie because of this issue. And I put it up on my website. And one of the folks that read that webcomic was an editor at Dark Horse Comics.
Uh-huh.
So a few years later, Dark Horse purchases from Nickelodeon the license to do these Airbender comics. And because this editor had read this comic of mine complaining about the live-action movie, she knew I was a fan, and she contacted me and asked me if I'd be willing to write it for them.
Wow. That's one of the most gratifying acts of revenge in a cultural way I've ever heard. That's great.
Yeah, I was just very excited to dive into this world. I asked her, do we have to reference the movie at all? And she said, no,
yeah.
Not at all. So
you have that great gig. You've won awards. You publish widely. You still work as an administrator at a high school?
I do. Years ago, I was a full-time high school teacher. I taught mostly computer science, but I did some math and some art as well. And a few years ago, I had to go part-time, but it's difficult for me to imagine leaving that community completely or just leaving education completely. I think I'm just as passionate about education as I am about comics.
And does being this big comic book guy and graphic novelist make high school kids think, hey, you know, Mr. Yang, he's cool. He does these things. He's not just a teacher.
Not at all. I think it's just hard to impress teenagers that you see on a daily basis.
Well, yes. Yeah. It's hard to impress teenagers, I think, is a given almost every
right.
culture. Gene Lin Yang, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Kurt. It was great to talk to you.
Gene Lin Yang is the author of Boxers and Saints and American Born Chinese. You can see some of his work at studio360.org. I talked to Gene 4 years ago, and a couple of years after that, he was named a MacArthur Genius and became the Library of Congress's National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, which made me want to check back in with him.
Hello?
Hello, Gene. This is Kurt Anderson.
Hi, Kurt. How you doing?
I'm great. And more to the point, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really excited.
So what is this ambassadorship entail besides, I don't know, ribbon cuttings at bookstores and libraries or something?
Well, the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature is a post that was started in 2008, so it's not very old. And the whole point is to get more kids reading and to get kids reading more.
So, Mr. Ambassador, how will you do this? How will you encourage young Americans to read more?
I really want to encourage kids to explore the world through reading, and I want them to explore in three very specific ways. Number one, I want them to explore the lives of people who are different from them. So I want them to pick books that have people on the cover that don't look or live like them. Two, I want them to pick subject matters, books about subjects that they might find intimidating. And my pet project here is to get more kids reading about STEM, about science, technology, engineering, and math. And then finally, I want them to pick books in unfamiliar formats. Nowadays, there's a huge diversity of formats out there. So there are graphic novels and prose novels and novels in verse and hybrid novels. I want kids to try all those different formats.
And have you taken your own advice? Do you say, well, these people are not like me and I'm intimidated by this, but by God, I'm going to read it?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up not liking sports at all, mostly because I was terrible at it, you know, especially basketball. Every time I played basketball, the ball would find some way of hitting me in the head. Well, I eventually got interested in basketball, just recently, really, and books played a huge part. I started by reading this book called Outside the Paint, which was about the basketball scene in San Francisco Chinatown in the 1930s and 40s. I had no idea there was even a basketball scene in Chinatown in the 30s and 40s. It was an amazing book, and that led to me reading a whole bunch of other books about basketball and getting really interested.
And in addition to becoming this National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, I understand, have been, I guess, to continue the basketball idea, called up to the NBA. That is, got a call from DC Comics.
I have said that before. I've told people that working for DC Comics is a bit like working for the NBA. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's been kind of like the 12-year-old inside of me is freaking out.
Sure.
About this.
I can imagine. The last time we spoke, you were working as a high school administrator, and you said then that you could not imagine leaving education completely because you're so passionate about it. But you've left education.
I did. I left because of Superman. When DC offered me the Superman gig, I just couldn't fit it into my schedule. And it was so hard. It was. It felt like I was breaking up with somebody. I ended up losing sleep for a couple of nights. I lost my appetite. It was crazy. But you know, I feel like, selfishly at least, this ambassadorship is kind of a blessing for me because it gives me another forum in which to connect with students.
Well, and I assume that your 16-year-olds who missed Mr. Yang certainly would understand, like, what? You're going to go write Superman?
Yeah,
yes!
they were really happy for me, for sure.
Well, congratulations. And it was great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kurt. It was great to talk to you, too.